This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, and welcome to Night Transmissions number 40. This is Gary Clinton, and no matter what anyone says, I don't think we should stop meeting this way. In fact, I think it's quite pleasant. We just get together quietly and listen to some old radio shows, and maybe listen to a story from the public domain delivered to us by the LibriVox Project. It's all pretty nice and pretty cozy. Speaking of cozy, well, cozy ain't what we got here for the first program. In fact, what we have is the opposite of cozy. We've got an episode of The Mysterious Traveler from September the 24th of 1944. Now, The Mysterious Traveler, if you're familiar with it, you know that it was a mixed bag. Some weeks there would be horror, some weeks it'd be fantasy, some weeks science fiction, other weeks crime drama. But it always specialized in the twist ending, the ironic. And tonight we have an episode like that. Pretty often stories of the traveler would revolve around, you know, pretty regular Joes and Jills. Joes and Jills. I've been listening to too many of these old shows, haven't I? The eras have begun to seep into me, and I've begun to pick up the vocabulary. But then, Joes and Jills they were. Anyway, before I digressed, I was going to say that pretty often a regular guy or gal would get involved through circumstances pretty much beyond their control in the seedier side of life. Tonight, a regular guy, in order to provide for his family, for his sick wife, becomes involved in crime. And, as is the general practice in these shows, gets punished for it. Anyway, sit back. The train is pulling out of the station. Let's listen to Maurice Talpin as the Mysterious Traveler.
The Mysterious Traveler.
This is the Mysterious Traveler, inviting you to join me on another journey into the realm of the strange and the terrifying. I hope you will enjoy the trip, that it will thrill you a little and chill you a little. So settle back, get a good grip on your nerves, and be comfortable, if you can. Where are we going? Why, we're going to follow the adventures of a man who thought he could commit murder and escape punishment. I call the story Death Laughs Last. It was while I was practicing medicine in an eastern city that Edward Harrison brought his wife Mary to me for an examination. I could see at a glance that she was dangerously ill. When I had finished my examination, however, I tried to conceal her true condition from her till I had a chance to speak privately to her husband.
It isn't anything serious, is it, Dr. Smith? Oh, please tell me that it isn't.
Well, I'm afraid it's too soon to say, Mrs. Harrison. Until the X-ray plates are ready, I can't say yes or no.
But
now your husband is waiting outside. He's probably beginning to worry, so...
Oh, yes, of course.
Here's your wife, Mr. Harrison. You must have thought I'd kidnapped her.
No, but I was getting a little worried, Doctor. I hope you didn't find anything very wrong.
Well, I took several X-rays, but I won't be able to tell much until they're developed. I'd like your wife to come back day after tomorrow, if she can.
Of course, Doctor. What time would be the best?
Well, any time that's convenient to you. Now, I'll write out a prescription your husband can have filled. Will you step in for a moment, Mr. Harrison?
Sure thing. With you in a moment, Mary.
Of course, darling.
Sit down, won't you, Mr. Harrison?
All right. Now, what is it, Doctor?
Mr. Harrison, your wife is dangerously ill.
Yes, sir. Does that mean she's going to die?
Her only hope is a brain operation. A very difficult and delicate operation. Without it, well, I could only give her 6 months, a year at most.
No, no, it mustn't be. She's got to have the operation, you hear?
I must tell you, Mr. Harrison, that only one man in this country has the necessary skill for the operation your wife needs. He's Dr. Howard Richards, and naturally he's in great demand. His average fee for an operation is about
$1,500. $1,500?
Well, of course, if you can't afford that, you might consider the circumstances and...
No, no, I can afford it. I can afford anything Mary needs.
Well, then I'll get in touch with him at once.
Yeah, sure. You make the arrangements right away, and I'll get a hold of the money. I'll get it to you by tomorrow, sure.
Help me off with my coat, will you?
Oh, sure, sure, Mary. Yeah. How are you feeling?
Oh, much better since Dr. Smith gave me that medicine in his office.
He's a swell doctor. He'll fix you up in no time.
Did he tell you anything more, Edward?
Not a thing, except that the treatment might take a little time, that's all.
A little time? Oh, dear, I hope it won't be too expensive. Your business hasn't been good, and we've used up all the money in our savings account, and...
Oh, don't you fret about money. Don't you worry about anything.
All right, darling. I won't. Oh, but aren't you going to take your coat off?
No, I've got to get the prescription the doctor gave me filled. You just take it easy till I get back. I might stop in at the shop, too. There's something I've got to attend to there. I'm Ed Harrison.
Oh, yes, Mr. Harrison. Please sit down. I see that you want to borrow $1,500 from us.
That's right.
Unfortunately, the security you offer, your home...
Well, what's wrong with it? It's a swell little house. Good section. All in good repair.
Yes, yes, that's true. But you already have a first and second mortgage on it, totaling $4,000. And, well, I'm afraid we can't make any further loans.
But I've got to have the money. I just got to.
I'm sorry to hear that, because there's nothing we can do to help you. Nothing we can do.
You say you're not employed, Mr. Harrison.
No, I own a shop. I'm a locksmith.
Mm-hmm. Well, that means you're never certain of your income. If you had a job now, a regular income you could depend on...
What are you getting at? You mean you're not going to let me have the money?
I certainly wish I could, but under the circumstances... Well, I'm sorry, very sorry, but there's nothing I can do.
I'm afraid the collateral you suggest isn't satisfactory, Mr. Harrison. We'd lend you the money if we could, but we just can't. Sorry.
But I've got to have it. I've just got to.
Sorry.
It's to save Mary's life. She'll die if I
sorry.
Don't. And I won't let her die. I won't.
Sorry.
I...
Sorry.
Look,
sorry.
You must...
Sorry.
Listen.
Sorry.
You must...
Edward, you aren't eating. Oh, and you're so quiet. Dear, is there anything wrong?
What? Oh, no, of course not.
You're worrying about me, aren't you?
What? No, Mary. I was just thinking about making some changes at the shop. And...
Darling, you don't have to lie to me. I know I'm not well, but I'm going to get better. Really, I am. I promise.
Oh, of course you are. Dr. Smith said so. You're going to be well in no time. Now I've got to go out. I have an appointment over the other side of the city with Horace Latimer. He wants to see me about something. Something important.
Edward had no appointment with Horace Latimer, but went to see Horace anyway. For he and Horace had been boyhood friends, and their paths had separated, and Horace had grown wealthy. But in his desperation, Edward Harrison hoped that Horace would remember the past and would lend him the money he'd been trying to raise all day. Horace could spare it easily. But would he?
$1,500? That's rather a lot of money, Ed.
I know it is, Horace, but it's for Mary, for an operation. I've got to have it.
Yes. Why don't you try the bank? You have a house, a business.
I have tried the bank and all the personal loan companies in town. They all turned me down, said the security wasn't good enough.
I see. Well, that's too bad. But I don't quite understand why you came to me, Ed.
Because we're friends, that's why. Because when we were boys, we agreed that we'd each of us always lend the other a helping hand if we could.
Boys don't understand business very well, I'm afraid, Ed.
No, I suppose not. They don't understand business. They just understand friendship. You know, if I had the money and you needed it, I'd lend it to you in a minute.
I don't doubt that at all, Ed. And you can bet I'd lend it to you if I had it. But that's the trouble. I haven't any ready cash. The income tax, you know, and a couple of shaky investments that I had to bolster up lately.
All right, Horace, never mind explaining. I get the idea. You're not going to lend me the money.
No, really, Ed, I would if I could, but I can't. I'm sorry,
save
but...
Save your sorrow for somebody else. I don't need your money, you hear? I'll get it someplace else. Yes, I'll get it. Somehow.
After he had slammed out of Horace Latimer's expensive home, Edward stood for a moment on the dark street corner, staring back with bitterness in his face.
Sorry. Yes, you're sorry. In a pig's eye, you're sorry. What a sap I was to think you were a pal of mine.
What's that, buddy? Oh, was you talking to me?
What? Oh, no, sorry. I guess I was thinking out loud.
Oh, that's okay. Hey, got a match?
A match? Oh, sure. Yeah. There you go.
Thanks. Okay, just hold it like that. Make a move and I'll plug you.
Gun?
Yeah,
why,
this
you...
is a stick-up. Hold your whole hand over your dough and make it fast, see?
My dough? That's a hot one. I'm out trying to raise money myself. We're both out of luck. I've only got a dollar on me. Take it if you want it anyway. It's more than I could raise.
Don't try to kid me. Stand still while I see what you got in your pockets. A wallet? A leather case of some kind.
You'll find just $1 in that wallet.
Yeah. A buck. One measly buck. I bet you got a roll hidden in this leather case. It's heavy enough.
There's nothing in there but my emergency kit.
Yeah, well, I'll just see for myself. Hey. Oh, this kit is full of skeleton keys and pick locks and stuff. What are you, anyway, second-story worker?
I'm a locksmith and a safe repairman, if it's anything to you. How about taking the dollar and letting me go on my way? I'm in a hurry.
Not so fast, pal. Not so fast. Were you leveling just now when you said you was trying to raise dough?
Yeah, I've got to have $1,500 by tomorrow. What's it to you?
You'd be surprised, pal. Okay, I'm putting the gun away, but you ain't leaving yet. Me and you, we're going to talk business. Because I got a plan that'll get us both all the dough we need. Two more beers, waiter.
Coming up.
Well, is it a deal on the proposition?
I don't know, Mike.
Sure you do. There's nothing to it. You can open locks and safes. I know where there's a house with plenty of dough in it. You and me together, we'll go get it. We'll make a team.
Burglary? I've never stolen anything in my life.
Listen, you said you needed the dough bad, didn't you? So do I, plenty bad. You said you'd do anything to get it, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Ed, then what are you hanging back for? All you gotta do is get the back door opened and the safe. In half an hour, you'll have your 1500 and more. How else are you ever gonna get it? Answer me that.
I don't know. You're sure the money's there, Mike?
Positive. I was casing the joint, looked in the window in time to see the old geezer put a whole roll of bills in a safe that's like a bread box. You could open it with your teeth.
All right, I'll do it.
I've got to have the money. I'll go on the job with you.
Okay, this is the joint. Everybody said they ain't long ago it'll be a cinch.
The luck looks easy. But I shouldn't be doing this. There must be some other way to get the money through.
Don't be a sucker all your life. You gotta take what you want in this world. If you don't, you'll never get it. Everybody's a crook of some kind. Take it from me.
Well,
get on. Get that door open. We gotta get inside before we're spotted.
All right. Let me take a second, I think. Yes. There. It's unlocked.
Okay. Get inside. The safe's in the library. Down this way. Don't make any noise.
You sure there's only two of them in the house?
Yeah, the old guy and his butler. Probably both of them deaf as posts. Hit the library. Come on. The safe's behind the picture on the wall.
This picture?
Yeah, that's it. I'll lift it down. There you are. That safe is just a kid's toy. Go ahead, get it open.
It won't be that easy. I'll have it open inside half an hour.
Now, hurry it up. You've been 40 minutes on that thing.
It's coming now. There. It's open.
About time, too. And now, let's see what's in it. Here's the cash box. Till I open it. Mazuma, what'd I tell you?
There must be thousands there.
Easy, come on, we'll count it and divvy it up.
No, never mind. Just give me 1,500, that's all I want. You can keep the rest.
Are you kidding?
No, that's all I want, just the 1,500 I need.
Okay, it's your funeral. Yeah, here you are. 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, $1,500 bills.
$1,500?
Yeah, for just an hour's work. Easy money, huh? What do you say? We crack a couple more cribs tonight?
No, no, I just want to get out of here now and...
Get behind this door. I'll take care of it.
Burglars! Jenkins, the police! Help!
What'd you expect me to do? Shake his hand?
But you killed him. Yes. I'm an accessory to murder.
Cut the guff and let's get out of here. Or do you want to get caught?
No, no, of course not.
Well, then let's get going. Come on, we can...
Stand still, both of you. I have a gun and I have you covered.
The butler.
If you move, I'll shoot. I can see you perfectly.
He's standing on the stairs. He's got a gun. We caught. We caught.
Oh, not yet. We ain't. Not by an old scarecrow with a rusty horse pistol.
Put up your hands. I'm going to call the police. You've done something to the master.
Hey, okay. We'll put up our hands. Fight fun, we will.
Oh.
You shot him.
We got to get out of here in a hurry. Those shots. Okay, here we are. Come on in.
But why did you make me come here? Why can't I go home?
You hide me. Come on in. It's better. Now, take off your hat and stay a while.
But I can't stay, Mike. My wife, she'll be worrying. Home to her.
You've got other things than your wife to worry about, chum.
What do you mean, Mike?
I mean the cops. Or have you forgotten? You're wanted for murder.
No, no, I haven't forgotten. I'll never be able to forget. Oh, why did you kill them? Why?
Well, it was either kill them or go to jail. Or would you rather have gone to jail, huh?
No, no, but I'm all mixed up. Did I get into this anyway?
You needed dough. That's how you got into this. And you got it, so now cut out the sob stuff.
Why won't you let me go home? Why did you make me come here to your room?
You're here so you and me can have a little talk.
Kind of a talk.
Well, chum, that door and that safe open. You and me got a future together.
Oh, I won't do it. I won't.
Sure you can always send a little note to the cops.
They'd get you, too.
I'd be a long ways off. Here, you got a sick wife. You can play safe.
You
don't think you can pull a job and go on as if nothing had happened. Somebody's always got to bear another.
I did it only for
a minute now, and you can't get out. Wait.
I'll have a get it off my chest.
Oh, no, you don't. You see, the second if I thought... Get away, go!
You got me into this. You with it? Take that gun away from me.
I'll put you out! Oh.
Mike. He's dead. I've got to get away.
days of horror and made his way to the street. Thoughts which he could not control round in his head.
I mean, they'll hang me. Hey, the money. The money to make Mary. Now they'll catch me. They'll hang me. I've got to. Paid for somehow. But if you can't escape, if you're lucky. I need a drink. I've got to have a drink before I go crazy.
So Edward Harrison's street. Struggling to control his shaking as normal, he ordered a double whiskey and gulped it. His senses cleared a little. He heard the radio at the end of the bar broadcasting a warning to the city.
Attention! The police dock for the following man. Committed in the Buxton Park. Please make a note of the following.
Say, buddy, what's the radio off for?
Because I was...
D, and I got a night I want to hear it. So I'm going to turn it back on again.
No, no, you mustn't.
But I'm going to. If you try a gun right here under the bar, see what that dirty killer looked like.
I repeat, be on night, lean and wiry, with reddish brown hair, in Buxton Park earlier this evening. A man reported once to now turn you back to our regular night owl program of popular dance tunes.
Lean and wiry with reddish brown hair, huh? Well, that ain't you. You're heavy set and blackhead. But for a minute there, you had me going. I was positive you was the killer the way you didn't want me to hear the description. I guess you just jumped me, huh? Well, here. Have another drink. On the house.
Thanks, thanks. I need some sleep. Yeah, that's what I need. Some sleep.
How close he had come to giving himself away, Edward Harrison hurried. Mike, the police were looking for, not Edward Harrison. They had. Edward Harrison was safe. His old good luck, Edward was asleep. Quiet and troubled by nightmare, Mary was already preparing breakfast.
Good morning, darling. Who?
I was pretty late. I stopped at the shop. It was pretty and did a little work. I forgot to watch the time.
Oh, and this morning you look terrible. I know. You're worrying about me. Oh, but you about me. Really, I am.
Of course you are. I'm going to see to that.
What do you think? Dr. Smith called up last night. He wanted to talk to you. Said he had some good news for you.
Good news?
Yes, but he wouldn't tell me what it was. I don't know why. He asked for you to stop in at his office this morning.
I think I know what it is. Yes, sure, I'll go right over and see him.
Oh, but darling, you're going to eat breakfast first, aren't you?
I'll eat when I get back. I want to see the doctor first. Anyway, I'm not very hungry.
Well, all right, Edward. But please hurry back. I want to know what the doctor says, too.
Yes, sure, Mary. I'll be right back. But everything's okay now, darling. Everything's okay.
After he left the house, Edward bought a morning paper. Big headlines told of the murders the night before, but he scarcely saw them. His eyes hurried through the story until he found what he was looking for. The news that Mike's body had been found. The butler Mike had shot had given the police Mike's description and then died before he could tell them there was anyone with Mike. So the police had listed Mike's death as a suicide or an accident and closed the case. Edward Harrison was safe. Perfectly safe.
Safe. I'm safe. Mike was wrong. Sometimes you can get away with murder and not have to pay anything if you're lucky. And I've been lucky. I've been lucky.
When Edward Harrison entered my office, he sat down beside my desk and tossed a folded newspaper into the wastebasket. His expression was that of a man who had just faced disaster and been rescued at the last moment.
Good morning, Doctor. Mary said you'd phoned. You had good news.
Yes, Mr. Harrison, I called you last night after I got in touch with Dr. Richards. I wanted to tell you that he had agreed to operate on your wife.
Oh, that's swell, Doctor. And I've got the money right here in my pocket.
The money, yes. Yes, I was also going to tell you that Dr. Richards had said not to worry about it. You could take as long as you wanted to pay it.
As long as I wanted?
Yes.
Then... it wasn't necessary. I didn't have to do it. I didn't have to do it.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
Never mind, Doctor. I mean, I've got the money. I want to pay it. He's got to take it right away. Well, what's the matter? What are you looking at me like that for? The operation is going to save Mary's life, isn't it? You said it would. You can go back on your word. You can, do you hear?
It's not that, Mr. Harrison. Yes, the operation would save your wife's life, but unfortunately, Dr. Richards was the only man in this country able to perform it.
Well, so what? He said he'd do it, didn't he? And I've raised the dough to pay him, so what's the hitch?
Mr. Harrison, Dr. Richards can't perform the operation now.
But you said...
He was tragically murdered last night by a burglar who broke into his home in Buxton Park. This is the mysterious traveler again.
Did you enjoy our little trip into the life of a man who thought he could make good come out of evil? Poor Edward Harrison. He didn't believe that crime must always be paid for by someone, did he? What became of him? Well, after his wife died a few months later, he confessed everything to the police. He didn't have anything to live for, poor fellow. But I hope his experience will teach you that crime really doesn't pay. I always say that it...
Oh, you're getting off at the next stop. I'm sorry. But perhaps we'll meet again soon. I take this same train every week.
You have just heard Chapter 42 of The Mysterious Traveler, a series of dramas of the strange and terrifying. In today's story, Death Laughs Last, Philip Clark played Edward Harrison, Carl Emery played Mike, and Elizabeth Morgan played Mary Harrison. The Mysterious Traveler is written by Bob Arthur and David Colgan, and original music is played by Henry Silverne. The entire production is under the direction of Jock McGregor. Now, an important message for all of you.
This is Jack McGregor speaking. The National War Fund Drive begins tomorrow. As you probably know, this fund includes over 22 of the major war relief and service organizations. As the war progresses on all fronts, more and more people will need help. Our armed forces, American prisoners of war, our allies, and people right here at home. And by giving to the National War Fund, you will be helping. Consider just one of the many organizations that the War Fund supports, the USO. More than 3,000 service units are in operation. Clubs where our service men and women find recreation. Dances, educational activities, reading, writing, and game rooms, and religious council. The USO is responsible for the traveler's aid desks, which help service men make connections and find sleeping accommodations. It operates the lounges in railroad and bus terminals. USO camp shows bring American entertainment to our troops at camps and stations throughout this country and in all of the combat zones. Groups who play the jungle circuit in the South Pacific, the desert circuit in North Africa, the grass skirt circuit in the Hawaiian Islands, and the foxhole circuit in combat zones just behind the front lines. We can't measure in money the good accomplished by the USO, but we can help to continue that good work by giving our money the National War Fund. So when your community war fund or war chest representative calls on you, give and give generously.
Listen next time to a tale titled
The Man the Insects Hated.
Another tale of the mysterious traveler. The Mysterious Traveler is presented by WOR Mutual from the WOR studios in New York. Beginning Saturday, October 7th, The Mysterious Traveler will be heard at a new time. It will be presented every Saturday evening at 10:30 Eastern Wartime over most of these same stations. So remember the new time, 10:30 p.m. Saturdays.
This is Mutual.
Guess what? This is a break. No, I don't really like it either. At least I get to run off and hide until it's over. I'll be back real soon. The Hall of Fantasy has often been considered one of the underrated treasures among old-time radio aficionados. It was originally a local series out of Utah that eventually found its way into syndication in 1952 and 3 through the Mutual Network. This series, written and directed by Richard Thorne, who was a prolific and extremely talented writer and producer of old-time radio, provided some very interesting and dramatic material. The acting in particular was superb, and although earlier episodes of the series concentrate on murder mysteries, this particular one, although it involves a murder, is a bit more supernatural in aspect. You see, these two men are on a fishing trip and return to their cabin to find a stranger who is there looking for a special doll that he needs for the dance, whatever that is. After a while, after the men go to bed, they hear this man talking to a shrill, demon-voiced something. After another while, he ends up dead. This is a fairly scary story, which has moments of absolute terror. I will admit that the resolution does seem a bit rushed and could be considered unsatisfying, but it's made up for by this dark final moment of the episode.
And now, the Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the series of radio dramas dedicated to the supernatural, the unusual, and the unknown. Come with me, my friends. We shall descend to the world of the unknown and forbidden, down to the depths where the veil of time is lifted and the supernatural reigns as king. Come with me and listen to the tale of The Dance of the Devil Dogs.
Hello? Anyone out here?
You don't think...
I don't know what to think, Chuck. We'd better take a good look around.
There's something strange about this whole set. I don't know... Emery.
What? Look. It's him. Come on. No wonder he didn't answer us, Chuck.
You mean...
That's right. He's dead.
In just a moment, the Hall of Fantasy will present The Dance of the Devil Dolls. And now for our story. An original tale of fantasy by Richard Thorne entitled The Dance of the Devil Dolls.
Have you heard of avoutement? Literally, the word means face image. The practice of avoutement is as ancient as Egypt and Assyria, and still found from Ceylon to the United States, Europe to Africa, South America to Scandinavia. A figure is made to resemble that of a hated enemy, then methodically injured or destroyed, resulting in pain and death for its human counterpart. Charles and I had gone up for a weekend of fishing. Saturday night at dusk, when the sky had dulled from blue to gray, and the gray was shading darker every minute, we were walking back up to the cabin.
Not a bad haul, huh, Emery?
For you, not for me. I'll bet you the smallest of those three bass weighs over 4 pounds. What bait were you using?
Oh, a spoon. Fish just wouldn't leave it alone. Anyway, we'll have a good fish dinner tonight.
And maybe tomorrow my luck will change.
Oh, I hope so.
What time is it?
About 9. We've been out 5 hours.
Chuck.
Yeah?
There's someone coming down the trail towards us.
Where? Oh, yes, I see. You
can't be going down to fish this late.
Oh, can't tell. Some guys really get the bug. There's a guy I know named Lloyd Erskine who will fish
Excuse
off...
Excuse me, gentlemen.
He means us.
Wonder what he wants.
Excuse me, gentlemen.
I lost something. I wonder if you found it.
I don't know what you're looking for, mister, but we haven't found it, whatever it is.
Perhaps you saw it lying on the ground. It was a doll.
A doll?
Yes, about 12 inches tall. It looked something like me.
I'm sorry, we haven't seen it. Of course, you can always buy your daughter
another. It doesn't belong to my daughter.
Oh. Well, we haven't seen it.
Are you staying at a cabin on this lake?
Yes. Only until tomorrow night. It's right at the head of the trail up there. You must have passed it as you started down.
If by any chance you do come across it, I'll stop in before I leave this area, if you don't mind.
Well, that's perfectly all right.
Thank you, gentlemen. I must have the doll for the dance tonight, or the old woman will be angry.
Well, what do you make of that?
Search me.
He talked so strangely. I must have the doll for the dance tonight, or the old woman will be angry. I think he's off his rocker.
Well, it's not our worry, Henry. Come on, let's go.
We went back up to our cabin, cleaned the fish, and had one of those fish dinners you talk about for years. It was about 11 o'clock, and we'd started to go to bed, intending to get up as early as possible the next morning when there was a knock on the door.
I wonder who that is.
I don't know, but we'll soon find out. Oh, it's you.
Yes. May I come in?
Well, of course.
I see you found the doll.
Yes. I wanted to let you know that I had.
Well, thanks for telling us.
Now I must take him to the dance.
The dance ought to be just about over.
Oh, no, it hasn't begun yet.
Well, you'd better get there or your wife will be angry.
You misunderstood me. I said the old woman, not my wife. You see, I'm not married.
Oh.
I hope you'll forgive me. I see that you're just about ready to retire, but I'm afraid.
Afraid? Of what?
The old woman is already angry with me. I told her I'd lost the doll, and she swore that if I didn't find it, she'd kill me. That's why I've come to you. If you hear that I'm dead tomorrow, that I committed suicide, you'll know it's not the truth. If I could only get in touch with Dr. George Kaltman, he could help, but I'm caught up in something I can't stop, and it's too late to get out now. I've tried to... Oh, my head!
You dropped your doll.
I didn't drop it. She caused it to move. She doesn't want me to talk. I've said too much already. I must go now.
Here's your doll.
Thank you. Remember what I told you. If I'm dead tomorrow... It's murder. Good night, gentlemen.
After he dropped the doll, did you get a good look at him, Chuck?
Yeah.
The doll hit the floor on its forehead. A few seconds later, there was a heavy bruise on the right side of his forehead.
You know, he said if he was found dead tomorrow, that it would be murder.
It was about 11:30 when we finally got to bed. We'd opened the windows of the cabin. The sound of the alarm clock we brought with us mingled with that of the crickets outside.
The old woman said you must die.
I heard something. I didn't know what it was. It sounded strangely like words, but they were uttered in a voice so tiny and shrill that I thought I was imagining things. But then, I heard his voice.
No! No, I won't die! They will help me!
Henry, I didn't know you were awake.
I couldn't sleep. I thought I heard a tiny little voice.
I thought I...
Hey, no!
The old woman will take care of them, too.
But I'm not going to die! I'm not going to... Ah!
Back now to our story. An original tale of fantasy by Richard Thorne entitled The Dance of the Devil Dolls.
Charles and I had retired for the night, but neither of us could sleep. Suddenly, from outside, we heard the voice of the man we'd met earlier, and another voice, high and shrill, and somehow deadly.
The old woman will take care of them, too.
But I'm not going to die! I'm not going to... Ah!
What's going on out there.
We'd better take a look.
There's a pair of pants and some shoes on.
Remember what he said about dying?
Yeah. You ready?
Yes.
All right, let's go. Beginning to think that guy belongs in an institution.
Maybe. Maybe not. I think a scream came from the left.
We'll take a look over there, then. Didn't tell us his name, did he?
No.
Well, I'll try calling him. Anybody out here? Hello? Anyone out here? You don't think...
I don't know what to think, Chuck. We'd better take a good look around.
Something strange about this whole setup. I don't know what... Emery.
What? Look. It's him. Come on. No wonder he didn't answer us, Chuck.
You mean...
That's right. He's dead.
That little dog looks so much like him. I don't see it anywhere around.
Neither do I. You know, Chuck, it sounds crazy to say it, but that shrill, high little voice we heard...
You're letting this thing run wild with your imagination, Emery. Even though it looked like him, it's just a doll, nothing else.
It had to be my imagination, of that I was sure. But the mere thought of it, of the doll which so resembled the man with its shining face and beady little eyes, caused a strange sense of apprehension and fear to come across me. And I glanced out into the darkness and saw only the lumbering shadows of the trees and heard the rustle of their leaves as they brushed together. I saw nothing, yet I had the feeling that something with beady little eyes was watching us. We notified the authorities. They came out, found no evidence of foul play, and diagnosed his death as being caused by heart failure. Our luck was exceptionally bad out on the lake Sunday, and we drove home that night, speaking but little, thinking only of what had happened the night before. About 10 days after we returned to the city, both Charles and I were home one evening. We shared an apartment together, and that night neither of us had anything to do. We were playing gin rummy.
One more hand like that and you'll be out, you lucky dog.
It was pure skill, my friend. No luck involved.
Cut? No, I trust you.
It's a good thing Pamela stood you up tonight.
She knew that you wanted a gin partner.
Don't be humorous. Proposed to her yet?
No, but I'm working on it. You know, you deal like a card shark. I have nothing but...
Expecting anyone?
No, you. Mm-mm. Well, I'll see who it is.
Whoever it is, get rid of him. I got a good hand.
Coming right up.
Is this the residence of Mr. Emery Ryerson and Mr. Charles Hunter?
Yes, it is, but...
I have a package for you.
Are you expecting a package, Emery?
Just bills, no packages.
It's for both of you.
All right, I'll take it.
Thank you. And good evening, sir.
Oh, yes, good evening. It's an old woman. She had a package for us.
Well, set it down on the table and open it, man. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth.
So I'll open it. It's wrapped very well.
Maybe it's a bottle of scotch.
Who would be sending us a bottle of...
Someone has a real fine sense of humor.
It's like the doll that fellow had with him.
It's the same doll. Notice that little nick out of its forehead? That happened when he dropped it on the floor.
What are we going to do with it?
I don't know.
We can keep it, I suppose.
Well, let's get back to the game.
No, I'm not in the mood now. You know, Emery, I can't help but remember what he said.
The man who died?
Yes. He said, I must have the doll for the dance tonight, or the old woman will be angry.
Yes, that's right. What brought that back to your mind?
The woman who delivered this package...
Put the lid back on the box and left it on the kitchen table with the cards we'd been using. Neither of us entered the kitchen again that evening. We went to bed a short time after 12. Again, I was restless and couldn't sleep. I had the same feeling I'd had that night in the cabin. And I remembered the words I'd heard spoken in that unearthly little voice.
The old woman will take care of them, too.
Thank you.
And I wondered if I'd only imagined those words, or whether they had actually been uttered by the creature in the box in the other room. It was then I heard it, like a thin, reedy piping. It sounded like music, a rhythmic, discordant melody I'd never heard before. And then I heard another sound.
Henry?
Yes?
Am I going crazy?
I hear it, too. I think we'd better see what it is.
All right. I don't like this, Henry.
It sounds like...
I know what it sounds like. Henry!
I can't believe my eyes.
The box is open. The little doll, Henry. It's moving. It's dancing on the table.
Back now to our story. An original tale of fantasy by Richard Thorne entitled The Dance of the Devil Dolls.
Charles and I couldn't believe our eyes, for the scene before us was as bizarre and fantastic as the wildest dream of an insane imagination.
It's moving. It's dancing on the table.
Yes, I see it.
There's something that... I'm going to destroy that thing.
Be careful. Look out, Chuck. It's running.
I'm going to get it if it's the last thing I do.
It's running over toward the window.
It's gone. It's gone through the glass.
Maybe it's down there on the sidewalk.
It's possible, but that's a two-story drop.
I can't see it.
No, Emery. It's gone. I turned again to the old woman.
The man who had died had mentioned the name that night in the cabin. The name of Dr. George Kaltman. Now it came back into my mind. Kaltman was associated with occult research. If Kaltman could have helped the man who died, perhaps he could explain what was happening to us. We got in touch with him and made an appointment for the following evening.
You have told me everything that has happened. Is that correct, gentlemen?
Yes, everything.
We'd like to know what it all means.
Well, I shall explain it to you as best I can. Have either of you ever heard of avoutement?
No.
Not that I recall.
Well, avoutement is the practice of making little dolls to resemble a hated enemy and then methodically injuring or destroying it, thus bringing about either pain or death or both in the doll's human counterpart.
Dr. Kaltman, this doll we saw last night, it moved, it danced.
I know. What you witnessed last night was the dance of the devil dolls.
You say these dolls bring about pain or death, Dr. Kaltman. Why should we be singled out?
The man who died told you about the old woman. Is that not correct?
Yes.
Therefore, you must be destroyed. She feels that you are dangerous to her, that you know too much. Undoubtedly, the woman you saw last night, Mr. Hunter, was the manipulator, controller of the little figures. Since you saw her, she has probably made little figures of both of you. But before it will live and be subject to her will, she must have a part of you. A lock of your hair, a fingernail clipping, anything that will make yours and the doll's identities one and the same.
What should we do?
Go back to your apartment. I shall return with you. She will send the little doll back to your apartment tonight. I'm sure of that. We must capture the doll, for it is the only thing that will lead us to her.
Kaltman, Charles, and I returned to our apartment and took up our vigil in the bedroom, for that was the place the doll and the old woman would expect us to be. We made dummies of the extra blankets and arranged the bed so it looked as if we were sleeping.
You left the apartment door unlocked?
Yes.
But why? It only makes it easier for it to enter.
That is what we must do. One way or the other, the doll would find means of entrance. If not tonight, then another. You have no idea what those little creatures are capable. Listen. It has come. Be quiet. Wait until it is in here. Then close the bedroom door and put on the lights.
We understand.
Now, quiet.
There it is, over there. This time it won't get away.
Don't let it get near the window.
I've got it. Quickly, put it in here.
There. We have it.
Now, what do we do?
The Starl will lead us to the Starl woman.
You mean now? Tonight?
Yes, Mr. Ryerson. She will know that we have captured her little messenger if it does not return in a few hours, and she will be prepared to stop us. We must find her, destroy her if need be, before she has a chance to destroy you.
Then began one of the strangest sights I've ever seen. Kaufman took the doll out of the box in which we'd imprisoned it, tied its arms and legs while it writhed and twisted in his hand. Then he began speaking to it.
It's mine.
Softly, rhythmically. Slowly putting it into a hypnotized sleep. The eyelids of the little figure finally closed, and it was in an hypnotic trance.
Sleep and tell me. Now, listen to me. You must tell me where your mistress is. You must tell me where your mistress is.
The house. The house of dolls.
The house of dolls.
It's a strange answer.
Not so strange, my friends. I know what it means.
What is it?
She's a diabolical person, this doll woman. The House of Dolls is a toy shop with rare and unusual dolls. What better place to hide? No one would suspect what was behind those burning eyes of hers. I myself have purchased dolls for my little granddaughter from her. We must go there immediately. We have no time to lose. This is the place.
Let's go.
Right. It's past two. There's no one on the streets.
Oh, it's a better. Try the door.
It's open.
Probably waiting in the rear of the shop for the creature she sent out.
Well, let's go in.
As quietly as possible. We must catch her by surprise.
All right.
There's a light coming from beneath that door back there.
That is where we must go. Listen.
It is the dance of the devil dolls.
The door is ajar.
They're in there. I can see them.
Yes, so do I. Be quiet.
And soon, my children, you will be joined by two others. And then, no one can harm you. For when the new doll returns, he will bring with him what I need for the spell of the dancers.
We must take her now.
And they will join you in the dance of the devil doll.
No!
What are you doing here?
We've come to stop you.
Look out, Holman! Look out!
So have I!
She is dead. She will cause no more harm.
Seems strange to see those little creatures on the floor. All of them so quiet and still. And just a short while ago.
They were participating in the dance of the devil doll.
Yes.
Do not feel pity for them, Mr. Hunter. The dolls did not really live. They were a creation of evil, sparked by the malevolence of the old woman. When she died, they died with her. Perhaps the humans they resembled will rest quietly now.
The secret of the devil doll is that old black man. It is lost now, but it will be found.
Tonight's tale of the unusual, the terrifying, the unknown. Join us again when next we journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy to hear another strange tale of the supernatural. All characters and events portrayed in these programs are fictional, and any similarity to actual events or persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental.
Another 5-minute mystery.
Organ, Al.
Oh, that's Keene Brown, Mike. I find it cheaper to hire him to play fill-in music than a full band.
What do you do for entertainment when he's off the platform?
There's a portable record player underneath the piano.
Oh, yeah, I see it. One of those battery jobs. Huh?
Yeah. We play dance music on it when Keene knocks off for intermission periods.
Okay, Al, I'm sold. This cabaret of yours looks like a sound proposition. I'll buy it.
Swell, Mike. I'll be back in just a few minutes. The contract's in my office.
Okay, is it? Hey! Hey, the lights have gone out!
There's an emergency switch in my office. I'll turn it on. Be back in a second.
I'm Keene Brown. You wanted to see me?
Yes, Mr. Brown. My name's Mike Evans. I'm just checking up on a few facts until the police get here.
Sure. What can I do to help?
This was payroll night for the employees here, wasn't it?
Yeah, Al usually paid us off after closing.
Well, you won't get paid tonight, Mr. Brown. Look at the safe. I'm not a detective, but it doesn't take an experienced eye to spot this whole thing as an inside job.
How do you figure that out?
Someone working here knew that Al had the weekly payroll in his office safe tonight. And only someone who was completely familiar with this cabaret would know the location of the light box.
Then all you have to do, Mr. Evans, is to establish the position of every employee at the time Al was shot.
That's right. Suppose I start with you.
Me?
No objections, I hope. After all, you've been here long enough to know how to turn off the electrical system for the entire building or to tell someone how to do it.
Are you accusing me?
No, I'm simply asking you where you were at the time the shot was fired.
You know where I was. I was on the stand playing my electric organ so there wouldn't be any panic.
That's right, I did hear you playing.
Correct the first time. Now, if you'll excuse me, I think I've had enough of your amateur detective work.
And there's nothing further you can do to help me?
Nothing, except to call a policeman and get this murder solved.
That won't be necessary, Mr. Brown. I know who the murderer is.
Really? Who?
You, Mr. Brown. You made your own confession.
How does Mike Evans know that Keene Brown is the murderer? In just a moment, we'll know, but first... Back to our story.
Brown, you admitted that the important clue in this case was to find where every employee of this cabaret was at the time the shot was fired. You claim to have been on the stand playing your electric organ. I heard the music, but whether I heard you, I don't know. I believe I heard your music coming from a record. A record on the player beneath the electric organ. You couldn't have been playing at the time the lights were out because the whole electrical system had been sabotaged. And to play an electric organ, you need electricity. Your speaker has to be plugged into an outlet. Right, I suppose. Brown, let's take up your suggestion. I'll call the police. There's been a murder.
Thank you.
I know. Another break. Well, what can I do? It's a promise to come back soon.
What we heard is some kind of message from space?
Yes, I do.
Well, I think it is, too. You see, this is Theater 5, and it's September the 23rd of 1964. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I remember 1964 really pretty well. And a lot of weird crap happened in 1964. For one thing, I turned 18. And a little later that year, well, we better not go into that. I think probably I should just shut up here. And let's get back to what he and she were saying, okay?
Well, suppose the message wasn't sent by an alien civilization. What if something else is trying to speak to us?
Something else? Do you mean some kind of super intelligence, some supreme being?
Yes.
Then in that case, I sincerely hope we can understand what the message is before it's too late.
Theater 5 presents We Are All Alone.
Ladies and gentlemen, please pardon the noise and confusion here, but this is an extraordinary event, and we're broadcasting under extraordinary conditions. This is Gary Benton at Stellar Observatory. Less than 1 hour ago, astronomers here, operating the planet's largest radio telescope, reported the reception of some sort of message from what seems to be outer space. It sounds much like static. But the significant thing is that the pattern keeps repeating itself. Now, according to Dr. Forrest, head of the observatory, this means that an intelligent source is sending it. Dr. Forrest is here at the scene of this excitement, and I'm trying to get his attention. Dr. Forrest! Dr. Forrest! Dr. Forrest, do you think we've heard from another planet?
Well, I don't know, but we're certainly hearing from somebody or something intelligent.
I see. Then you believe there are other civilizations in the universe besides our own?
Quite definitely. As any physicist will tell you, there are countless billions of suns, many of them with planet systems around them. Oh, yes. There's someone out there, all right. And they're waiting for us. Waiting and perhaps calling. From somewhere in outer space.
Theater 5 is presenting the radio drama, We Are All Alone.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Gary Benton again, coming to you from Stellar Observatory, where something really fantastic has occurred in the past hour. We just spoke with Dr. Forrest, head of the observatory, and as soon as possible, we will broadcast a tape of the noise pattern which has come from outer space. Please stand by for further details. We are now switching back to your local station. So much for that. Till things start popping again. Hey, who's got a match?
That's a telephone for you.
Oh, thanks. All right, coming. Thank you. Hello?
Gary? What's going on up there?
Plenty, Ray. The boys up here think they've hit the jackpot this time. They claim it has to be something intelligent that's sending that noise.
Why that?
Because the same pattern keeps coming in. They never heard anything like it.
Can it be just going
Not up? A chance, no. Look, they had a computer figure it out.
Huh?
After the sixth repetition, the chances of a seventh are astronomical. More than 10 is just about impossible, and this thing's been going on for an hour.
Well, all right, but I got troubles down here. Linda Maxwell wants to go on with her show.
Uh-oh.
She says that her listeners aren't interested in space. They just want to hear
her. Is she kidding? This may be the biggest thing that's ever happened to us. This thing's so hot, the president of the planet has a direct line to this place. Look,
Ray, I think you should just play music and hold everything open for what happens here.
Suppose nothing
happens. It will. They're going to give me a tape recording of the sound to play on the air. Why don't you have Linda stand by just in case, huh?
Okay, I'll tell her.
Yeah, and give her my love, huh?
Yeah, right. Talk to you later. Now for the fight. Linda, I just spoke with Gary Benton up at the observatory.
Ah, yes, the talented Mr. Benton. And what words of wisdom does he have for me now?
Well, Gary says that things are popping up there. He's going to get a tape to play very soon.
What about my listeners?
Well, this is a news special, you know. And it just might be the most important event ever.
Oh, I know it, Ray. And I suppose I can't really argue the point. It's just that, well, you know how I hate to let that inflated ego of Gary's get any bigger than it is already.
You know, I believe you and Gary must be secretly married, the way you two go around throwing barbs at each other.
Not a chance, Ray. We're both much too smart for anything like that.
Meaning that you'll wait until he asks you.
Well, maybe.
So why don't you just wait in the studio? Gary wants you to stand by in case something goes wrong.
Oh, hey, I have a better idea. Suppose I go up to the observatory and split the news with Gary. That way my listeners could hear me, and then everybody's happy.
That's not a bad idea. Besides, it may be good to get a woman's viewpoint of what's happening.
Ray, listen, do you really think there's anything to it? I mean, this message from space?
Oh, I don't know. It's possible, all right.
But if it is true, then we're not alone anymore.
That's right. What about it?
Well, it's spooky, that's all. I mean, we've sent satellites into space. We've been sending messages out of the universe for years, but this is different. Somebody's sending us something.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's an answer to one of our messages.
But if it is that, it's even more scary. Then whoever it is must be very much like we are. Maybe a whole planet just like us.
Well, the universe is big enough for both of us, I suppose. Now, look, how about you getting up to the observatory and start sending us messages?
Okay, I'm there already. The next voice you hear will be that of Linda Maxwell from outer space.
Well, for Pete's sake, what are you doing up here?
Well, maybe Ray wanted somebody with a little human feeling in on a story like this.
Very funny.
All right, Jerry, I'm sorry. Come on, tell me what's going on here.
Well, from what I've been able to piece together, there were two men on the telescope when the noise started coming in.
Yeah.
Dr. Forrest, who's head man, and Professor Sanford, a physicist. They're both tops in their field.
Which is
radio astronomy. For several years, they've been sending out signals to all parts of the universe, hoping to contact other civilizations. At the same time, they've been listening to sounds coming in, hoping to hear something intelligible.
And tonight they heard.
They sure did, baby.
Well, where's the tape now?
Dr. Forrest has it. He's going to give me first crack at it to play it on the air. We've got the newsbeat of the year.
Well, what's the noise sound like?
It's a little weird, especially when you realize it may mean something.
What are you doing now?
I'm going to play you a tape of what they usually hear when the telescope is on.
How do they get this sound?
Well, from what Dr. Forrest tells me, they aim the telescope at a particular area of the sky. Then they tune in on a specific frequency and turn on the radio receiver.
And they record whatever they hear.
Right. Here, listen to this. Mm.
That's all coming from space?
Every bit of it.
Then the sounds we're hearing
are the sounds of the universe.
Oh, boy. Makes me shiver.
Each of those sounds is coming from billions of miles out in space. Some of them have taken thousands, maybe millions of years to get to us.
Mr. Benton, Dr. Forrest would like to see you.
Thank you. I'll be right back, Linda. I think he wants to give me the tape. Dr. Forrest?
Oh, Mr. Benton. Come in. I'd like you to meet Professor Sanford.
It's an honor, Professor.
And for me, Mr. Benton? Dr. Forrest tells me that you've been following the progress of our little adventure almost from the beginning.
That's right, sir.
I must say, I admire your patience.
Stubbornness would be more like it, Professor. I figured if I made a pest of myself long enough, I'd get the inside track on the story, so... Well, here I am.
Now, Mr. Benton, I have the tape that I believe you wish to play for your listeners. The president of our planet has already been notified and is being kept informed of developments.
Well, sir, have you been able to determine anything definite yet?
Well, there's more to be done, of course, but I can say this. Perhaps the most
fantastic thing of all is the strength of the radio waves.
The strength?
Mm-hmm.
What Dr. Forrest means is that an unknown radio source far beyond the universe we know is sending us signals on 10,000 megawatts of power.
But that's more power than my whole radio station uses.
That's what the reading is, and there's no mistake.
Well, Mr. Benton, suppose you play the tape and we'll get back to work.
Yes, well, thank you, Dr. Forrest and Professor Sanford. Linda, get the engineer to cue up this tape right away. I'm going on the air as soon as he opens my mic. Hmm? Ladies and gentlemen, this is Gary Benton at Stellar Observatory. We have just received the tape of the sound pattern which has come to us from outer space. In just 1 minute, you will hear what is believed to be the first sound ever received from an intelligence somewhere in space. Please stand by.
Theater 5 is presenting We Are All Alone.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Gary Benton at Stellar Observatory. I'm about to play a tape recording for you of the noise pattern that came from outer space earlier this evening. Scientists here at the observatory believe that the pattern is a message, and that somewhere far out in the universe, something intelligent is trying to communicate with us. The next sound you hear is coming from outer space.
Goose flesh.
Why?
I don't know. It's just spooky.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have just played for you what may be the first message ever received from outer space. Scientists are now determining what that message may be. As reports come in, we will broadcast them, so please stay tuned. Well, that's that, at least for the moment. I hope the president of the planet was listening.
Gary?
Hmm?
Listen, suppose this, whatever it is, isn't friendly. I mean, suppose it wants to destroy us. What then?
Well, first it has to get here.
If it could send messages, it could get here.
Well, it's a little different, Linda.
All right.
One big difference is that radio waves travel through just about everything. Bodies can't do that, at least not that we know of.
But just suppose it did happen. What would you do?
My love, I'd gather you up in my arms and run as fast as I could.
Oh, dear.
Telephone for Mr. Benton.
Oh, thanks. Benton here.
This is Ray, Gary. Here at the studio.
Yeah, what's up?
Oh, boy, things are really popping. We've had about 100 calls already on this message from outer space, and they're coming in faster than we can take them. And I have personally spoken to two men who claim to understand the message.
What?
You heard me. Both of them claim that they can understand what is being said, and what's more, they know where it's coming from. One of them fell on his head when he was 12, and ever since then he's had visions of the day when this message would come.
Yeah, what about the other?
Well, the other one knows all about the message because it's for him.
I see. Well, go on.
It seems that he is not of this planet. He came here many years ago from his home, billions of miles away in another galaxy. Now they want him back. Now that's what the message is, telling him to come home. Look, seriously, Gary, I just wanted to congratulate you on being the first to get this on the air. It's the biggest thing that's ever happened around here.
Well, thanks, Ray. I'll call you later at the studio. You'll be there, huh?
Where else?
Right. That was Ray.
Well, did he say my listeners are storming the building because they can't hear me?
Yeah, something like that.
I thought so.
Hey, here's Dr. Forrest, the professor. Come on, I'll introduce you.
Oh, okay.
Oh, Mr. Benton.
Sir. Well, how did the broadcast go?
Just fine, Doctor, just fine. I'll return the tape after I've run it once more.
Good.
Meanwhile, this charming young thing on my arm is Linda Maxwell. She's my assistant. Mm. Linda, Dr. Forrest, Professor Sanford.
How
pleasure. How do you do, Maxwell?
Anything new, Doctor?
I'm afraid not. We've tried radio telegraphy with no luck. We've just finished running the pattern through the modulating receiver.
Oh, what does that do?
It breaks down the electromagnetic wave. The wave pattern is carrying the electrical equivalent of sound waves. Then the receiver can reproduce the original sound.
You mean a voice?
If that's the original sound.
Well, sir, what were the results of your test?
It's definitely not what we expected.
I see. Well, if something is being sent out, what form would it take? I mean, for example, would it have our alphabet?
Hardly. It would probably be a mathematical formula. Equations are constant everywhere in the universe.
Yes, that's the only common bond there is, of course.
You mean everything else, history, culture, is meaningless to an alien civilization?
Well, in terms of our experience, I'm afraid so, Miss Maxwell.
Well, what do you do now, sir?
Well, there's one more experiment Professor Sanford and I want to try. It's a long shot, so I'd better not say anything about it just yet. But we should know the result very soon now.
Dr. Forrest.
Yes, Miss Maxwell.
Suppose the message was not sent by an alien civilization. What if something else is trying to speak to us?
Something else? Do you mean some kind of super intelligence or some supreme being?
Yes.
Then in that case, Miss Maxwell, I sincerely hope we can understand what the message is before it's too late.
Ladies and gentlemen of the news media, Professor Sanford and I have called all of you here to acquaint you with the test results we mentioned several hours ago. Now, let me begin by saying that after our initial shock, we noted the rather odd fact that the radio waves were coming in at 82.2 megacycles.
That's the frequency we use for satellite communication. We'd expect radio waves from outer space to come in the more universal 50 megacycle range, if they were sent by a living intelligence.
Exactly. So we began to suspect that our intelligent sender of messages might be aboard one of our own lost satellites.
What? One of our lost satellites?
Yes, Mr. Benton.
But how is that possible, sir? I mean, a lost satellite can't just travel billions of miles into space and then suddenly begin sending radio messages back. Where would it get the energy?
I think I can answer that, Mr. Benton. The satellite could be in a solar orbit that includes a number of planets. A strong magnetic field around these planets would trap enough sun particles to ionize the transmitter.
I see, and that would give it the tremendous energy required?
It could be as simple as that. To check this theory, we submitted the noise pattern to the decoding scanner. Everything was double-checked. And there's no doubt that the mysterious message from outer space, the something that is sending us a repeating pattern, is a transmitter in one of our own satellites.
Where it is, we don't know, and we'll never know. Certainly billions of miles away, perhaps in another universe.
And I thought this was the story of the century.
Oh, but it is, Mr. Benton.
Now, how do you mean, sir?
From an emotional viewpoint, this is quite naturally a shattering disappointment. But not from the scientific point of view. This lost satellite is sending us information that will revolutionize our thinking. Already, we know of a planet that has a dead moon near it and a fantastic amount of radioactivity surrounding it. Who knows what else we shall learn? Well, you'll excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. There's much work yet to be done.
Professor Sanford.
Yes?
Professor, are you going to call the president of the planet now, sir?
Oh, yes. I'm going to let President Moore know that this is a scientific breakthrough of major importance.
Thank you, Professor.
Well, Linda, it seems the all-powerful stranger from another planet turns out to be a phantom of our own imagination and invention.
Then we are alone. All alone.
No, Linda. Not ever all alone.
People, planet. This is your president speaking. It is with sadness that we acknowledge the continued failure of our efforts to contact other civilizations. For many years, we have listened to the sounds of the universe, hoping to hear alien messages. We must now conclude that we fail because there are no such messages. It appears inescapable that at this moment in the history of the universe, we, the inhabitants of the planet Orbis, one of the two planets around our sun, and one of the countless billions in the Gamma Galaxy, are the only intelligent living beings in the vast reaches of space. We should feel both humble and proud. In the limitless universe, only on the planet Orbis are there people who can marvel at the beauty of the sky. The sky that is there just for us. People of Orbis, let us give thanks.
Well, I knew Gary was a common name, but I had no idea it was universal. My cousin Linda may be interested to hear about this, too.
The Troubadour. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Corey Samuel. The Troubadour by Robert Augustine Ward Lowndes. So far as parties go, Jocelyn's were no duller than any others. I went to this one mainly to listen to Paul Kutrov and Frank Alva bait each other, which is usually more entertaining than most double features. Kutrov adheres to the onward and upward school of linear progress, while Alva is more or less of a Spenglerian. More when he goes along by himself, less when you try to pin him down to it. And since the subject of tonight's revelations would be the pre-Mohammed Arabian culture, I'd find Alva inclined toward my side of the debate, which is strictly morphological and without any pious theories of progress. I'd completely forgotten that Jocelyn had mentioned something about having a special attraction, a Mr. Phalis, who, she insisted, was a troubadour. I didn't comment, not wanting to spend a day with Jocelyn on the phone exploring the province. The night wasn't too warm for August, and there were occasional gusts of air seeping through the layers of tobacco smoke that hovered over the assemblage. As usual, it was a heterogeneous crowd, which rapidly formed numerous islands of discourse. The trade winds carried salient germs of intelligence throughout the entire archipelago at times, and Jocelyn walked upon the water, scurrying from one body to another, sopping up the overflow of culture. She visited our atoll, where Kutrov's passionate exposition had already raised the mean temperature some degrees, but didn't stay long. Such debates didn't suggest any course of social or political action, and couldn't be trued in to any of her causes. My attention was wandering from the Kutrov-Alva variations, for Bill had only been speaking for 10 minutes, and could not be expected to arrive at any point whatsoever for at least another 15. From the east of us came apocalyptic figures of nuclear physics. From the west, I heard the strains of Mondrian interwoven with Picasso. South of us, a post-mortem on the latest betrayal of this or that aspiration of the people. And to the north we heard the mysteries of atonality. It was while I was looking around, and letting these things roll over me, that I saw the stranger enter. Jocelyn immediately bounced up from a couch, leaving the crucial problem of atmosphere poisoning via fission and or fusion bombs suspended, and made effusive noises. This, then, was the troubadour, Mr. Phalis. The main attraction was decidedly prepossessing. Tall, peculiarly graceful both in appearance and manner, dressed with an immaculateness that seemed excessive in this post-Bohemian circle. There was a decided musical quality to his speech, as he made polite comments upon being introduced to each of us, and an exactness in sentence structure, word choices, and enunciation that bespoke the foreigner. Jocelyn took him around with the air of conducting a quick tour through a museum, then settled him momentarily with the music group, now in darkest Schoenenberg, only partially illuminated by Wozzeck. I watched Valis long enough to solidify an impression that he was at ease here, but not merely in this particular discussion. It was a case of his being simply at ease, period. Kutrov was watching him too, and I saw now that there would be a most likely permanent digression. Too bad. I'd had a feeling that when he came to his point, it would have been a strong one. "Hungarian, do you suppose?" he asked. Alva examined the evidence. Valis had high cheekbones, longish eyes, with large pupils. He was lean, without giving an impression of thinness. He had not taken off his gloves, and I wondered if he would come forth with a monocle. If he had, it would not have seemed an affectation.
"I wouldn't say Slavic," Alva said.
He started off on ethnology, and we toured the Near East again. I jumped into the break, when Kutrov was swallowing beer and Alva lighting a cigarette, to observe that Phaelis reminded me of some Egyptian portraits, although I couldn't set the period. "If those eyes of his don't shine in the dark," I added, "they ought to." A brief pause for appreciation. Then Jocelyn was calling for all men's attention. She managed to get it in reasonably short order, took a deep breath, then dived into announcing that our special guest, Mr. Phaelis, was going to deliver a song cycle. Phaelis arose, bowed slightly, then nodded to Mark Loring, who brought forth his oboe. "These songs were not conceived or composed in the form I am presenting them," he said, "but I believe that the arrangement I use is an effective one. I call this Song of the Last Men." He nodded again to Loring, and the performance began. His voice was affecting, and his artistry unmistakable, and there were overtones in his voice that gave an added eeriness to the weird music itself. The songs told of the feelings, the memories, and despair of a nearly extinct people, one which had achieved a great culture and a worldwide civilization. The singer knows that the civilization has been destroyed, that the people created by this culture and civilization are gone, the few survivors, being pitiful fellaheen, unable to rebuild or bring forth a culture of their own. There is despair at the loss of the comforts the civilization they knew brought them, sorrow at their inability to share in its greatness, even in memory, and a resigned certainty that they are the last of the race. They will soon be gone, and no others shall arise after them. There was silence when Phaelis finished, then discreet but firm applause, as if the audience felt that giving full rein to their approval would make an impious racket. Phaelis seemed to sense this feeling, and smiled as he bowed. "These are not songs of your people, are they?" asked Jocelyn. Phaelis shook his head. "Oh no, they are far removed from us. I am merely an explorer of past cultures and civilizations, and I enjoy adapting such masterpieces of the past as I can find. This arrangement was made for you. I shall make a different one for my own people, so that the sonic values of the music and the words agree with each other." Kutrov blinked, then asked him, "Well, can you tell us something more about the people who created this cycle? It has a familiar ring to it, yet I cannot tie it in with any past culture I have heard of." Jocelyn cut in with the regretful announcement that Mr. Phaelis had another appointment, and called for a note of thanks to him for coming. More applause, this time unrestrained. Phaelis smiled again, and swept his eyes around us, as if filled with some amusing secret. Then he said to Kutrov, "You would find them quite understandable." I wandered over to the window in search of air, and noted that someone had indiscreetly left a comfortable chair vacant. I was near the door, so that I could hear Jocelyn say to Phaelis, "It was very moving. Why, I could almost feel that you were singing about us." Phaelis smiled again. "That is as it should be." "Of course," chimed in Loring, who'd come up to ask Phaelis if he could have a copy of the score. "That's the test of expert performance." The lights were dimmed again by the fog of tobacco smoke, and I could see the street quite clearly by moonlight. I decided I would watch Phaelis, and see if his eyes did glow in the dark. I saw him go down the sidewalk, with that graceful stride of his hands in his pockets, but I couldn't see his eyes at all.
Then a gust of wind tugged his hat, and, for an instant, I thought he'd have to go scrambling after it, but quick as a rapier thrust, a tail darted out from beneath his dress coat, caught the hat, and set it back upon his head. End of The Troubadour by Robert Augustine Ward Lowndes.
One last break here, and then we'll be right back. And finally, for our last dramatic presentation, we have an episode of Sleep No More from April the 17th of 1957. Then we'll face the music until the end comes. If after the end you feel at all disposed to communicating with me, there are a couple of ways you can do it. You can email me at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. You can drop by the website, www.nighttransmissions, one word, no space between the night and the transmissions, nighttransmissions.com, and contact me there through the contact button on the navigation menu. In the meantime, good night. Sleep well.
Is Nelson Olmsted. Sleep no more. Sleep no more. Turn down the lights. Sink back in your chair and don't look into the shadows. In the shadows, there may be moving things. Tonight, it may be you will sleep no more. This one is a light-hearted and, to me at least, delightful fantasy by Virginia Swain called Aunt Cassie. It was odd, Edward Alden thought, as he struggled with his dress tie, how one little old lady, really very kind and well-intentioned, could so rub a whole family the wrong way, all this, too, in front of a guest. That the guest was only that nincompoop boy, John Nesbitt, whom Eileen thought she was in love with, made it worse, not better. In front of Johnny, Mary had called Aunt Cassie an old dodo, and Eileen a hysterical little fool. And he, Edward, had shouted at them both to keep quiet. And when they wouldn't, he'd rushed out of the room and slammed the door. Well, only Aunt Cassie had behaved like a perfect lady. She had come teetering on her dainty feet into the room where Eileen was entertaining Johnny and said, in the careful diction acquired in 1875 at the Oxford Female Seminary, "Eileen, dear, your great-uncle Horace is standing behind you there. He wants to tell you that in our family, young ladies never sit up after 10 o'clock with young gentlemen to whom they're not engaged." Eileen had given one blank look and then begun to cry, and her parents had come running. Mary, with a horrified look at Eileen, sobbing and crumpled on the sofa, had made a lot of unintelligible clucking sounds, shot a glance of pure hatred at Johnny Nesbitt, and turned to Edward in a way that showed she meant him to deal with this, Aunt Cassie being his aunt, not hers. Aunt Cassie caught her look and turned to Edward, too. She said, "Well, you understand, Nibby, it's not my opinion, only Uncle Horace's. He's been trying for days to tell Eileen, but I met him in the linen closet yesterday, and he said that since you were all too stubborn to see or to hear him, I'd better tell her. He said, 'Tell that girl, that's not the way to catch a husband.'" Her voice was sweet and low, and she smiled with innocent affection upon them all. It was then that Mary had called her an old dodo, and Eileen had stopped whimpering and begun bawling, and he had yelled at them all and gone out and slammed the door. He could recall how Johnny had sat like an ugly gingerbread man in his brown suit, bolt upright, at his end of the couch. He was still annoyed with Eileen. It was embarrassing for the kid, of course, but she had been trained for 12 years in the proper way to deal with this crotchet of Aunt Cassie's. And she should have risen to the emergency last night. When Aunt Cassie came to live with them, Eileen was 6, and they'd explained everything to her. If Aunt Cassie spoke to someone who wasn't there, she was only dreaming and you ignored it. If Aunt Cassie pointed out to you someone that you couldn't see yourself, you said yes, politely, and remembered that old ladies live a great deal in the past, and sometimes it makes them happier to pretend that persons who are gone are still around them. Eileen had accepted it like a good little sport, and together the three of them had weathered 12 years of Aunt Cassie. She was a decent old girl in every other way. She mended all their clothes and made spiced pickles and jellies and kept herself attractive with nice old lace and rather coquettish dresses of gray and lavender. She had her own money. Not much, but enough to pay her own way. Yes, he had to admit, pushing his starched shirt flat and watching it buckle out again, she paid a little more than her own way. If she weren't helping with the household bills, he couldn't have afforded to buy that second-hand car for Eileen's graduation present last June. Also, her doing the sewing gave Mary more time for her club work. But he acquitted himself of any mercenary motive for having Aunt Cassie in his house. He was fond of her, and she had done a good deal for him when he was young. But by heaven, if she was going to upset Mary and Eileen... Oh, now, suddenly, his anger veered around. Eileen needed a good talking to. Oh, she was a nice girl, but Mary spoiled her rotten. She had no sense of responsibility, no gratitude. She'd been downright unpleasant tonight about his taking her car, which he himself had given her as a graduation present. He was going to take it regardless. With his own car in the shop and this insurance banquet 20 miles away, there was nothing else for him to do. When he'd given up trying to keep his shirt front flat and had brushed his hair for the fifth time over his bald spot, he walked across to the chest of drawers and pulled out a whiskey bottle from under a pile of shirts. He took a good long pull at it. Then he filled a flat silver flask and put it in his hip pocket and put the bottle back in the drawer. When he went down to the dining room, the three women were standing there waiting for him. Mary, rather quiet and shamefaced, came across and hunched his dinner jacket up in the back over his collar and patted him. Eileen looked sulky. She cast a young, disdainful eye over his gala costume and said, "You be careful of those brakes, Dad. The car shouldn't be driven that far until they're fixed. There's ice all the way to New Canaan, and they haven't sanded it yet."
"I'll be careful," he said,
looking at the decanters in the sideboard. It was going to be a cold drive, and if he took a little shot from one of those, he'd have his flask intact for the evening. He let Mary help him on with his coat and hand him his gloves. He stiffened his knees, and somehow that made his shirt front pop. But he walked masterfully to the sideboard and poured himself a drink. Aunt Cassie said, "My goodness, there's Betsy." There was silence for a moment, except for the noise Edward made in swallowing his whiskey suddenly. "Must seem funny to you, Nettie, to hear your mother called Betsy. I know that Yankee preacher she married always called her Elizabeth, but down home, she was Betsy." She turned slightly away from him toward the doorway. "Yes, Betsy? What is it?" Again, there was silence. But in the silence, the three of them, Mary, Eileen, and Edward, turned against their wills to face the door. After 12 years, you'd think they'd stop doing that. Aunt Cassie was nodding her head and then shaking it. "Oh, yes, Betsy, I know. He's drinking too much spirits. It's bad for his blood pressure. He ought to let the stuff alone when he's going to drive a car." She paused. "Yes, yes, I know you died before automobiles became common. Nowadays, the police will arrest you if they catch you driving when you're drinking. Betsy, have you seen much of Mother lately?" Edward set the glass down on the edge of the chest so that it tottered and fell off, spilling a few drops of whiskey on Mary's prized oriental rug. He glanced at her and saw that she looked angry, but whether with him or with Aunt Cassie, he couldn't judge. He seized his gloves again and went out in a hurry. He had to check his pace for front steps because they were slippery. Road wasn't so terribly slick. Once out of town, he stepped harder on the gas and said to himself that there was no danger so long as he didn't have to use his brakes suddenly, and he wouldn't have to, for there was nobody else on the road. He'd just have time to make his appointment if he got up speed. He began to hum to himself. He took a back road north of Darien, which cut 4 miles off the trip. People avoided it because it was narrow and One point crawled for some distance along an edge of a ravine. That made him laugh. He knew that road like a book. He felt good and warm inside and confident. His headlights cut a brave swath in front of him. Going was wonderful. Smooth as glass where the ice covered the ruts he had met there the last time. He was going to get to his banquet on time. The lights that cut across him from the curve ahead blinded him completely. The roadster jerked and waltzed and skittered and dropped into space. Later, when he pulled himself out from under Eileen's wrecked car, his first thought was to notify the state police. Well, that guy hadn't even stopped. He made his way back home. He was dry enough. At least he felt dry. Perhaps because his clothes were frozen. Even his shirt stopped popping and stood out like a balloon in front of him. During the last mile, when he was really beginning to feel somewhat light and giddy, he steadied himself by thinking, oh, Eileen will have a fit seeing me coming in looking like this. But he was so glad when he turned into a street and saw his home that he forgot the ruined roadster in the gorge, the criminal carelessness of the fellow who had pinned those sons on his fender, even the lurking suspicion that if he had not taken those two big slugs of whiskey and an empty stomach, he could have checked the crazy dancing of the flipper. He climbed the steps, went into the house. The hall and front parlor were dark. The women used the back parlor after dinner, Mary busy at her needlepoint, Eileen poking a tune out of the piano, and Aunt Cassie darning socks or reading beside the gas fire. He tried to shrug off his outer coat, but they wouldn't leave him. When he reached to take off his hat, he remembered that it was icebound somewhere in a hollow between Darien and New Canaan. He struck numb, stiff fingers against his shirt front and saw that they made no impression on it. All right, then. He'd go back into the back parlor as is. Wait till they heard what had happened to him. He'd have to buy Eileen another car. Only fair when he had ruined hers. As he went through the front parlor, he thought of last night and Johnny Nesbitt and wondered why he'd let it perturb him. There was nothing to worry about. Mary loved him. Eileen loved him. Two delightful women who made up his life. From behind the double doors, he heard conversation. Eileen said, oh, it was mean of him to take my car tonight. He knows Johnny and I always go to the movies on Saturday night. And then Mary said rather feebly, he thought, well, he did have to go to that dinner. Edward took a step forward and stood in the wide doorway. The women were at the other end of the long room. For a moment, he thought Eileen had seen him, but she couldn't have because she dropped her eyes calmly again to her hands lying listlessly in her lap. There was only one lamp burning in the room beside Mary's chair. He felt deflated because nobody had looked up and cried out with horror at his battered appearance. He crept into the shadowy end of the room and sat down close to the dull glow of the grate. But still they didn't notice him. Eileen was absorbed in her own discontent. She turned back to face her mother and said, why couldn't you have picked me a better father, Mother? You must have been a darn attractive when you were a girl. He turned in agony to look at Mary, but she wasn't looking shocked or angry, only puzzled and a little sad. And she said, well, Eileen, it may surprise you, but he was considered very attractive, too, when he was young. And I couldn't foresee Aunt Cassie, you know. Well, he could bear no more of this. He sprang from his chair and strode toward them into the circle of the lamplight. Mary, he said. Mary, I'm here. I had a wreck, but I got home all right. Nothing happened. Eileen went on pacing up and down, and his wife didn't raise her eyes from her embroidery. There was a light tapping of feet on the hardwood floor outside the parlor door. He knew it was Aunt Cassie, and he was annoyed because he wanted to get this straightened out with Mary and Eileen. Aunt Cassie was just inside the door now, and she said in her bright social manner, well, Liddy, how is it over there? When you see Uncle Horace, tell him to pay me a visit. Was there anything particular you want me to tell Mary and Eileen?
You can turn up the lights now. You can look around you. Nobody is there, really. Everything is all right, isn't it? Tonight, we have heard Nelson Olmsted telling Aunt Cassie by Virginia Swain. You have been listening to Sleep No More, an NBC Radio Network production directed by Daniel Sutter. Mr. Olmsted's albums are recorded exclusively for Vanguard Records. Until next week, when Nelson Olmsted will again be here in person, this is Ben Grauer bidding you good night.
Every time we say they allow you to go. When you're near, there's such an air of spring about it. I can hear.
Your eyes beam like sunlight on the gull's wings, and the leaves dance and play after you. Take my hand and hold it as you would a flower. Take care with my heart, oh darling, she's made of glass. Your eyes feel like sunlight resting on me, and the birds cease to sing when you rise. Ride easy, your fairy stallion you have mounted. Take care how you fly. In the pastel shades of sunlight, I have wandered with my eyes, my ears, my heart strained to the full. I know I've tasted the essence in those few days. Take care who you love, oh darling, he might not know.
Crying cockles.